Now, I want to go on and talk about the reliability of the New Testament, and we will specifically target the resurrection and the claims of Christ next time. You have to do a fair amount of spade work that anticipates the question of the reliability of the New Testament. You can't just immediately jump into it necessarily. You've got to deal with some issues about methodological naturalism, theism, objectivity of truth, and we'll get into some of that more when it comes to kind of postmodern historiography. Yes. Mm-hmm. Oh, yes.
But also, they don't have an understanding of what that culture was like and what the Jewish culture was like and, you know, how the oral traditions and how there was always some people around. So I think that that's a really important thing to say. These are all the reasons why we can believe the reliability. There were, you know, there were people who didn't believe that Jesus was the Lord, yet nobody ever attacked, you know, the Gospels, or nobody, if it wasn't true, somebody would have said something.
Oh, sure. I mean, the whole question of the importance of oral tradition is a very different culture. They wrote things down. Obviously, they had the scrolls of the Hebrew scriptures, and it could be that even the disciples of Jesus may have jotted a few things down as he was speaking. But the teachers, the rabbis, taught in a memorable form because it was an oral culture. It was a culture that prized memory. And there were rabbis, I think they found evidence of rabbis in the second century who had memorized the entire Hebrew scriptures. And think about that. The human mind is capable of unbelievable achievements before television. Phenomenal achievements. When it's focused on something it takes to be of supreme value and retains the focus over time, and if this is constitutive of your community, then people need to memorize. There were the writings, but they were not as available. I mean, I've got right here, look at this. I've got like all these Bibles right in front of me. Now, they didn't have that in the time of Jesus. So memorization was prized, and disciples memorized the teachings of the masters. Most non-Christians don't have a clue that that's true. They don't have any background about ancient Jewish culture. They're thinking, you know, the telephone game, where one person tells another person, tells another person, tells another person, and by the time you get around the room, you get something totally distorted. Well, ancient oral memorization was not the telephone game. And moreover, when you look at the gaps, I mean, we have two principal gaps. The gaps between the first manuscripts and the first writing, and then the gap between the writing and the events. In fact, both gaps are small enough to encourage trustworthiness in the scripture. But let me come back first of all to some questions of basic historiography, the problem of the past, the problem with ancient documents. I mean, some people say, look, it's an ancient document. You can't trust ancient documents, period. They're so far removed. They're pre-scientific. They're filled with myths and legends and so on. Well, we've dealt with some of that already. But one thing you have to do is play fair. And this is important with new people interested in the New Age movement. Is they will tend to be very skeptical about the Bible sometimes. Well, you know, it was written long after the events, and it contradicts itself. But then when you talk about Buddhist writings, you have their attention, their complete and utter attention. Or Hindu writings. Or Taoist writings. Well, as I said, Buddhist scriptures 500 or 600 years after the death of Buddha. 500 or 600 years. Hindu scriptures don't even try really to connect specifically with historical datable space-time events. It's not really significant for those scriptures. So one thing is consistency. I mean, people have a love for ancient wisdom as long as it's Eastern, and then become highly skeptical and critical of the Bible are just not playing fair. Are you going to be consistent or not? If you love everything ancient and you don't think being ancient is a bar to being true or important, then you have to at least take the Bible seriously to be consistent. So try to help people be consistent. They might not even realize they're being inconsistent. But people might say, look, you have tremendous difficulty with documents relating to the past because they tend to be prejudiced, incomplete, were removed from them in time, and ancient documents most all would be male-oriented. This is material from Cordovan, Chapter 9. Now, how do we begin to address that? Prejudiced, incomplete, removed in time, male-oriented. Well, for one thing, if someone took the time to write an ancient document, they were concerned about it. And they may have had a perspective to advance. But that, in and of itself, does not discredit the document. Some of the best histories we have of the Holocaust are written by Jews who survived the camps. And we don't discredit their testimony because they had a particular perspective. We don't discredit the writings of Elie Wiesel, for instance, because he's a Holocaust survivor and he's written many novels and articles about it. So simply having a perspective or an orientation does not intrinsically disqualify a document, because every document, especially documents about titanic issues that are addressed in religion, have a perspective. Incomplete. Yes, they're incomplete. There are a lot of things we would like to know about Jesus that we don't. We have no idea what he looked like, unless the Shroud of Turin is legitimate, and that's questionable. But nothing from the Bible about what he looked like. Very little about the time between about ages 12 and 30, called by the New Agers the lost years of Jesus, when he went to India and Tibet, and we'll talk about that later as well. Those are all summarized in one verse, Luke 2:52. Jesus grew in wisdom and stature before God and other people. It's not important to the gospel writers that we know what he did during that time. Those are the summarized years, not the lost years. So they are incomplete. And the writers of ancient gospels didn't have the sort of agenda that modern biographers have. That doesn't mean they were wrong. It doesn't mean they're untrustworthy. Male-oriented, that could be a tougher one in terms of ancient patriarchal cultures. But I think the way of dealing with that, with respect to the Gospels and the New Testament in general, is to say you've got to understand something of the Jewish and Roman culture of that time was highly patriarchal, tended to oppress women quite a bit in a variety of ways in terms of ownership of property and the ability to communicate in public and things of that nature. I know I'm being very general. And in fact, when you look at the ministry of Jesus and when you look at women in the early church, they're doing far more than was common in that culture, either ancient Greek or ancient Jewish culture. Women actually were being freed up to do far more than they had done previously. So the account of universal male bias runs aground when you point out those kinds of things. And again, people may not see it because they don't know much about the cultural background. I have a very short chapter in On Jesus, which thank God has not yet gone out of print, about Jesus' view of women. And it was very intentional why I put that in that book, because that book is an apologetic for Jesus, if you haven't noticed. It's also approaching Jesus as a thinker, as a philosopher, and having a worldview. I think they go together perfectly. But one of the reasons that a lot of contemporary people give for not taking Christianity seriously is that it is intrinsically and incorrigibly male-oriented. God is male, and humans made in the image of God are more like God than women, and men should have authority over women forever. That's the way God did it. Now, I take all those propositions to be false. And I haven't been able to argue that sufficiently in class. I've given you some links, given you some suggestions, and I deal with that more in another class called Christian Ethics and Modern Culture. But at least we can say that Jesus and the early church respect and give women a lot more freedom and opportunity than was common in that culture. Women are the first witnesses of the resurrection. Okay? That's very interesting in that culture that worked out that way. You have female prophets in the New Testament. Your sons and daughters will prophesy, Acts 2, quoting Joel 2. You have women prophesying in the church in Acts, rather in 1 Corinthians 11. So them being silent can't mean they don't say anything. They're prophesying, for heaven's sake. Priscilla is a teacher with Aquila. She's usually mentioned first in those accounts. Priscilla and Aquila showed... that passage in Acts. Barnabas? Apollos. I'm sorry. Apollos the deeper doctrine and so on. She was obviously a teacher. She had some authority as a teacher. We could go on there. But one thing you can do is look at it in terms of the hermeneutical circle. Now, what does Corduan mean by that? It's a pretty fancy term. When you're looking at a historical document, you use the hermeneutical circle, what does that mean? It's not an occultic divinational device. Right. The more you read, the more it modifies your presuppositions. So no one comes to any text completely neutral, completely objective in the sense of totally impartial. You have a background, you have some knowledge of Christianity, maybe a good sense about it, maybe a terrible sense about it. Maybe all you've ever heard are skeptical, critical arguments about the Bible. So you come to it with a lot of skepticism. But when you read it, some of that skepticism might be abetted, might be ameliorated. You may see that it reads a lot more naturally than you thought it would, that the miracle stories seem to fit a coherent narrative, that the miracles seem to fit the teaching and worldview of Jesus. It's not this wacky fairy tale that I thought it was. And you say, well, what's in these documents? Well, it's interesting, because oftentimes the apostles are shown to be completely clueless. They're bewildered. They don't understand what Jesus is doing. Jesus says things that don't maybe fit what we think he might say, like, I don't know when the second coming is going to be. Who touched me? He seems to get quite angry at times. It has the marks of something historical, not a fictional piece. So the hermeneutical circle is you bring assumptions to a text, you look at it, then you start asking questions of the text. You want to use appropriate standards. Now, what you have, let's see, where do I want to get to this? Yeah, I didn't specify, but Corduan talks about when you read the New Testament, you have personal references, like in the epistles, you know, bring me my cloak when you see me again. You have little inexplicable things that just read like they're legitimate history. They're not part of some grand story that someone was concocting. There, some of the events are episodic, like the epistles are written by one person to either a large group of people or to one person. The Gospels, of course, are written for a larger audience. So you try to get into the text and ask the questions of, does this read as an account of something happening in the ancient world? And you need to use appropriate tests of truth. He lists some of the criteria there that you look at, and I didn't write that down. If somebody can find that before I do. Yeah, 174, 175. Questions, how close in time is the document to the event in question? Does the author have a reputation for truthfulness? Is the document internally consistent? Was the author a direct participant in the event in question? Does the document report events that are clearly impossible? Is the document consistent with other documents? Are the events mentioned in the document referred to anywhere else? This is known as multiple attestation. Does the document show evidence of systematic bias? Is there some other reason to suspect deliberate distortion? If we have only a copy of the original document, is the copy an accurate reproduction of the original? So he argues what he calls interpretive realism. You're trying to interpret the meaning of the document through an honest investigation of what it says and what it claims. The manuscript test and the external corroboration test. Now, I know that if I fall short in the actual nuts and bolts of the authorship of the Gospels and the synoptic problem and all that, that we have very, very good scholars here who can take up the slack. And you will be taught this in more depth, I think, in your New Testament classes. But it's important to go over here as well. Let's talk about the manuscript test. What is that, the manuscript test, with respect to the New Testament now? It has to do with the number and the quality of extant manuscripts. So this has to do with the transmission of the original documents through time, the journey from then till now. Now, this is a necessary condition for reliability. It is not sufficient. Why not? if the original document is not true, it could be transmitted flawlessly and still be false. Okay? So this is a necessary condition. It is not sufficient. It's amazing how many people think that the Bible cannot be trusted because, let's say it all together, it's been translated so many times. And people have this sense that there were some original versions of the New Testament books, the autographs. And maybe they were in Aramaic, and then it was translated into Greek, and then the Greek into Latin, and the Latin into German, the German into French, the French into English, and so on. And by this time, we're 6 or 7 languages away from the original. Now, I hope you know that's not true. In terms of the language barrier, if you want to call it that, what are all the translations based on? Greek, which was the original language. Just telling people that is significant and important. It's not the case that it's gone from language A to B to C to D and then you have no access to the original language. Okay? So the language barrier problem is not there. Now, in terms of the quality and the number of manuscripts, you talk about the most ancient manuscript, which is a fragment from the Gospel of John. What is that? The Chester Beatty papyri? I can never remember. John Ryland's papyri? Whatever it is. Is it Ryland's? Okay. So that's a fragment from John, which is around 120 AD, something like that. That goes very, very far back. Now, when you add up all the Greek manuscripts for the New Testament, the last time I checked in Metzger, it was something like 5,366 complete or partial Greek versions of the New Testament. And it's not that they're all bunched into the last 200, 300, or 400, or 500, or 1,000 years. Many of them go very far back. The first complete collections were later on. But if you take this bulk of manuscripts and the quality of the manuscripts and compare it to other works of ancient literature, it comes out very, very well. Far better than other documents that are taken to be basically reliable. The works of Plato, Aristotle, Homer, and others. Now, this is a necessary part of the argument. It's not sufficient. But a lot of people are stuck at this part of the argument. Remember John Montgomery, an apologist that really emphasized historical apologetics and still does, saying he was debating a non-believing philosopher, I think it was Avram Stroll, and he backed Stroll into a corner. And he said, "Stroll, if you don't believe that the New Testament has been accurately transmitted through time, given the manuscript evidence, you must throw out the entirety of classical literature because it is better attested than any other piece of classical literature." And apparently Stroll said, "Fine, I throw it out." And then someone in attendance at this debate from the classics department said, "My God, Avram, not that." Be out of a job. Now again, are you going to play fair? Are you going to be consistent? This is very significant. I found a recent book, Anthony Weston's book, A Practical Companion to Ethics, claiming this about the Old Testament. That the Old Testament is translated from language to language to language, so it's really not trustworthy as a source of morals. And I emailed him about it. And I said, "This just is not true." And he apparently granted what I said, but then when the next edition came out, it was still in there. Now, I don't know, maybe he didn't have time to make the change, maybe he just forgot conveniently, I don't know. But in his book, A Practical Companion to Ethics, not to get specific, he makes this argument. It's just, you know, this just everybody knows this. Whenever people give that, but everybody knows this kind of response, and it's against Christianity, it's almost always false. You find this in New Age circles all the time, too. They say things like, "Oh, well, everybody knows that the Bible used to teach reincarnation, but it was suppressed by the early church." I mean, I've seen people just have one sentence and then they go on as if this was some kind of an argument, or it's like saying that water is H2O. What seems plausible to people may be highly irrational. You have to remember that in apologetics. What seems plausible and natural may be highly irrational. And this argument, you can't trust the Bible because it's been translated so many times, doesn't work. As I say here, the Muslims claim the Bible has been corrupted where it contradicts the Quran, but we have extant manuscripts that go back to the time of the Quran that agree with manuscripts now. And Muhammad endorsed the Old and the New Testaments in the Quran. This is a very tricky situation for the Muslims. We'll come back to that later. Now, the test really is to take any modern Bible translation and look at the variant readings at the bottom of the page. They never address any substantial matter of doctrine that's not addressed elsewhere. And usually they're just variations of wording. They don't address anything significant with respect to doctrine or ethics. So there are some disputes in the science of textual criticism, but they're minor. And it's remarkable how much evidence and how good the evidence is with respect to the manuscript test. Okay, necessary but not sufficient. Questions or comments there? We're only part of the way there, but that's one gap, right? The gap between the original documents and then the transmission of the documents and how they have come to us through time. Yes? Mm-hmm. Yeah, would he have the power and the knowledge and the intention to do so? It seems like it. But then you do have to investigate the contingent empirical claims to really verify it. And then you've also got some competition now. You've got the Old Testament only with Judaism, or you have the Quran supposedly usurping the Old Testament and the New Testament. So you still have to do some work there. But you set up a very friendly conceptual environment to the concept of revelation through natural theology. That's why I hammer it so hard. Some people want to have an entire apologetics just based on special revelation, basically. Arguments from prophecy, or the beauty of Scripture, or some kind of presuppositional approach. I think that limits the tools that we have available. And I've given you an article, which I won't make explicit reference to, from Paul Mayer about archaeology and the Old Testament. Now, we have really a world-class scholar here in that issue, Dr. Rick Hess. He has been involved in archaeological digs, and he is extremely good about the historical reliability of the Hebrew Scriptures. I defer to him, and I give you this article. We'll talk about the Old Testament a little bit later, but please take a look at that. So we have artifacts. We have verification of the Pool of Bethesda, the existence of Pontius Pilate, and quite a few confirmatory instances of things related in the New Testament. Now, do we have everything? No. But you don't get everything from extra-biblical sources because, as I said last time, people at that time, with respect to the writing, didn't really know how significant Christianity or Jesus were going to be. And in terms of archaeology, that is always partial, it's always limited, and it's always a game of probabilities. It's a game of reconstruction. But we do have some pretty strong confirmation of historical personages, places, and so on. But remember this when you're considering the reliability of the Bible. Some people basically say the Bible is guilty until proven innocent. They don't come out and state it explicitly. But the assumption is, like you read these articles about the Old Testament, and they say, there's really no evidence that Abraham existed. Well, you know, there is this ancient book that's been revered for millions of people, by millions of people, for, you know, thousands of years, the Hebrew Scriptures. They claim Abraham existed. Do we just write that off? It's really amazing the kind of methodology people use. Implicitly, they don't come out and say it. But it's like, this has basically no credibility unless it's verified by other sources. Well, what about the possible intrinsic credibility as an ancient, venerated source of knowledge? Do you just rule that out in principle? And it's amazing how it's stated. I read this in a U.S. News and World Report special edition called Mysteries of the Bible which is about the Hebrew Scriptures. And I remember one of the authors saying that. There's no evidence that Abraham existed. Well, what about the Bible itself? Saying, well, there's no corroborating evidence. Well, that was a very long time ago, so maybe all the evidence is unavailable. It's been said oftentimes the absence of evidence is not necessarily evidence of absence. It depends on the situation. Now, sometimes the absence of something is crucial in evaluating it. In fact, that's true with the book of Acts. We'll get to that. There's the argument the book of Acts was written before 70 AD because of what's missing from it. Now, that argument works. So, consider the presuppositions, the assumptions, sometimes the presumptions, of writers, anyone, in evaluating the Bible. Oftentimes, there's that standard, guilty until proven innocent, or if it's only attested in the Bible, then we have no evidence that it's true. That's interesting given the nature of the Bible itself, its antiquity, its veneration, and so on. I'm not saying you leave it at that level, but that's something to bring up. Now, we have the internal test, the nature of the documents themselves. Once again, there are a lot of unbelievers today who really are ignorant of the Bible. They may have strong opinions about it, but they don't know much about it. Now, there are unbelievers who are very articulate in their unbelief, and they may know more about the Bible than you do in some ways, and they don't believe it. But I think there's a significant class of people who get their views of religion and Christianity primarily from television, movies, things they hear on the street, and various snippets here and there, and a couple of years of Sunday school. And that's it. And because they're entitled to their opinion, and because opinion equals truth to a lot of people, they haven't really investigated and researched it. So they may not even know what the internal evidence for the Scriptures is. They don't know what the evidence actually is. They don't know what's there. Now, when you read the documents, talking about the New Testament primarily, you have statements that reveal that the writer was either an eyewitness or consulted eyewitnesses. The prologue to Luke is quite famous in that respect. Luke says previous people wrote about the life of Jesus, but he has researched this thoroughly and wants to present in an orderly fashion to his audience what happened in the life of Jesus. 2 Peter 2:16 talks about the writer being an eyewitness. We did not engage in myths and fantasies, but we were eyewitnesses of His Majesty. The end of John, you see the writer saying that he was there, he observed these things. You see it also in Galatians 1, Hebrews 2:3. And again, with these ancient documents, typically what historians do is they say innocent until proven guilty, not guilty until proven innocent. But when it comes to Scripture, oftentimes the standard is reversed. C.S. Lewis has a great essay you should all read at some point called Modern Biblical Criticism, which is in this collection called Christian Reflections. How many of you read that, Modern Biblical Criticism by C.S. Lewis? It's a classic. Everybody should read it. Paul's read it. All right. Let's hear it for Paul. 1 out of 100. Lewis is writing as a literary critic. He was an expert on medieval and Renaissance literature. And one of the reasons he believed the New Testament was that the stories did not read as fables or legends or myths. And he was an expert in these genres. And in fact, he said the miracle stories of the Bible are not good enough to be fantasy. Another writer, A.E. Henry, said that, or is it, I quoted him in On Jesus, I think it's A.E. Henry, or Harvey, rather, said that the stories are not embellished, they're cut to the bone. And they're very different than the kind of miracle stories you get in the apocryphal Gospels, let's say in the later 2nd and 3rd century. I can't remember which document this is, but there's one account of Jesus as a child making clay pigeons and then making the pigeons come alive. Does anyone remember? It's not the Gospel of Thomas. It's not Thomas. That's just all statements. There's not stories in there. It's one of those. Anyway, we'll find out which one it is later. That story made its way into what religious book? The Quran. That story is in the Quran. There's no reason to believe it ever happened. It was probably late 2nd, 3rd century document. It's a fanciful embellishment. It doesn't fit the category of a gospel. You see, there's no purpose to it. It doesn't serve any higher purpose. Whenever Jesus performs a miracle, it means something. It's not like a trick or something he does to demonstrate power for the sake of demonstrating power. There's no spectacle in the miracles of Jesus. And the way the miracles are written up, as Lewis says, they're not good enough to be fiction. They're really very matter of fact, very straightforward. As Harvey said, really cut to the bone. And it's only the later apocryphal gospels where you get these very fanciful and embellished kinds of stories, like the clay pigeon story. So we've got to look at the internal nature of the documents. And we have claims to eyewitnesses or consulting to eyewitnesses. Now, some people say, well, these arguments don't hold up because the early church felt very free to invoke ongoing revelations of Jesus. So what Jesus said when he was on earth and what was said about him later really flow into each other because the church felt the freedom to attribute sayings to Jesus after he was gone and to do this through the inspiration of the Spirit. Now, a good argument against that is how Paul treats questions, I think, in 1 Corinthians 7, where he says, now, I have this from the Lord. Then he says, but this is my view. And he's distinguishing his own view from what Jesus said. And there's other evidence as well that the early church did not feel free to invent statements about Jesus, but they were bearing witness to statements about Jesus. Moreover, a lot of the things that Jesus says in the Gospels did not have direct pertinence to the early church. And that's actually a good sign of authenticity, that Jesus was interacting with things in his ministry that were not of direct relevance in the early church. Or, for instance, he refers to himself as the Son of Man quite often. It's his favorite self-description. Son of Man appears hardly anywhere else in the New Testament. It's for whatever reason, it's just not taken up by Paul or Peter or anywhere else. There's very, very little reference to that. It goes back to Daniel 7, I think, 13 and 14. It's a messianic image, messianic title. So the early church was just not free to make up new sayings about Jesus. Moreover, there was a very early tradition of the teachings of Jesus, the standards of Jesus. And the church had to deal with deviations from it very early on. Read the book of Galatians. There were divisions and deviations from the early teaching. And this is a very important point, the point of oral tradition in that culture. We touched on it last time. There's been some recent scholarship on this, that around the time of Jesus, disciples of teachers, of rabbis, would memorize the teachings of the rabbis, and people had tremendous powers of memorization. In fact, when you look at the sayings of Jesus, they're quite memorable. You could see how people could memorize these and hand them down to people before they were written. And some people think, look, if it wasn't written down immediately while these things happen, it's not trustworthy. Because if the synoptics are written before 70 AD, that's still about 37 years after Jesus leaves the scene. But given the standards of ancient history, that's not that long. And given the fact that you have multiple attestation, not one gospel, not two, but four, and given the fact that people prized the words of teachers, rabbis, this is starting to look a lot more fruitful in terms of being historically accurate. And a lot of people simply don't know that people prized memorizing statements of teachers at that time, because we simply don't do that in our culture, typically. Yes. Sure. Oh, yeah, I'm sure if Jesus is teaching at different groups at different times for probably about 3 years, he would repeat himself quite often. And good teachers always do that, especially when they change audiences. And if the disciples are with him for 3 years, living with him, listening to him and taking what he taught and teaching it themselves to some degree, then they would know inside and out what he stood for, what he thought, how he communicated.